From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, unlike the United States, the United Kingdom, where I'm sitting in the middle of the United Kingdom right now, did not go to daylight savings time this weekend. There's a simple explanation. They don't have enough daylight to save. I'm looking at it right now. It's still, quote, daylight outside. It's paving stone gray. Is what the sky looks like right now. You wouldn't be wanting to save that. You'd want it to. You'd want to pee it away. So I hope you all turned your clocks wherever you needed to turn them. But here in London, the clocks have stayed put for a while until this rumored springtime thing surfaces. We'll be keeping an eye out for it. Ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. Vatican workers have hoisted a chimney onto the roof of the Sistine Chapel in readiness for the conclave of Catholic cardinals, the conclave of Catholic cardinals for you alliteration fans that will elect a successor to the Pope. The new Pope, not new Coke, new Pope. The conclave begins on Tuesday with the sequestered cardinals. This is Reuters. Oh, no, the Irish Times. So that's where sequester belongs, with cardinal hoods. Using the chimney to tell the outside world whether or not they have chosen a new leader. Black smoke signifies no decision. White smoke announces a new pontiff. Red smoke means, I guess they're having chili for dinner. Here's how it works. They attached a rust-colored pipe above the tiles of the roof of the frescoed chapel. Inside the chapel, workmen carried out the final preparations to make the room ready. Two stoves were installed and attached to a single flue leading up to the roof. One made of cast iron and used in every conclave since 1939 will be used to burn the ballots after they're cast. Hey, why don't they try that in Ohio? The second stove is an electronic one with a key, a red start button, and seven tiny temperature indicator lights. Flares will be electronically ignited inside it to send out either white or black smoke. So, yes, it is a simulacrum of what it is supposed to be, because it's like a color organ inside an electronic stove to say black or white, or, you know, red for chili. Superbugs, ladies and gentlemen. Superbugs are among us, nightmare bacteria that have become increasingly resistant to even the strongest antibiotics, infected patients in 4% of U.S. hospitals in the first half of last year, and in 18% of specialty hospitals. This is what public health officials revealed this week. Our strongest antibiotics don't work, and patients are left with potentially untreatable infections, says Dr. Tom Frieden of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He says doctors, hospitals, and public health officials must work together now to stop these infections from spreading because we are defenseless. Over the past decade, more and more hospitalized patients have been incurably infected with the bug carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. My Latin isn't what it never was, but the initial CRE will have to do. It kills up to half the patients who get bloodstream infections from that bug, according to a CDC report. They belong to the Enterobacteriaceae family, which includes more than 70 species that normally live in the water, soil, and human digestive system, such as the well-known E. coli. That's what the E in E. coli stands for. That's why they don't pronounce it when they're saying it. It's E. coli, ladies and gentlemen. Over the years, some of these bacteria have become resistant to all or almost all antibiotics, including the last resort drugs known as carbapenems. Over the last decade, the percentage of the E. bacteria that are resistant to these last-ditch antibiotics rose by 400%. One type of CRE, a form of a pneumonia bacteria, has increased sevenfold. In the last decade, almost all CRE infections occur in patients receiving medical care for serious conditions in hospitals, long-term acute care facilities, or nursing homes. These patients often have catheters or ventilators, which afford the bacteria access to the inner sanctum of the body. And I guess they don't even have to bother in news reports now to say why bacteria are developing rapidly such extreme resistance to antibiotics. Because we're using them too much.
Really?
Yeah. Still using them to fatten up meat in industrial meat places, in industrial meat factories. And doctors are still prescribing them like crazy because we want them. Because ask your doctor if they're right for you. So stay out of hospitals and nursing homes. Good advice from the good hands people at Hello, Welcome to the Show.
Saturday night.
From the heart of London, England, just off Leicester Square, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now...
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's like they knew I was going to say that. Ladies and gentlemen, the legacy of all the money the U.S. wasted in Iraq might be summed up with a single quote. $55 billion could have brought great change in Iraq. That's from Prime Minister al-Maliki to the U.S.'s Iraqi Inspector General. In fact, the U.S. spent $60 billion in its often fraudulent efforts to rebuild the country it invaded, occupied, and has now left. With the 10-year anniversary of the Iraq invasion looming, Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, considers $8 billion of that money just wasted. I know the feeling, man. And that's a conservative estimate, he says. We couldn't look at every project. That's impossible. But our audits show a lack of accountability, he told Wired.com. We are not well structured to carry out stability and reconstruction operations. Now he tells us. That is nearly the whole story of the Iraq War's expense. Bowen is only looking at reconstruction money, not the cost of military ops, which totaled over $800 billion. But this week, Bowen's office released a mammoth final report into the botched reconstruction itself, which cost the U.S. taxpayers, on average, $15 million every day from 2003 to 2012. $15 million every day. Why, we could have... Bought a lot of lottery tickets with that. It turns out there wasn't just one way to waste all the money. Some projects got started and never finished, like a prison in Diyala province that languishes unbuilt nearly 9 years after $40 billion was spent to build it. Other contracts went to cronies. The top contracting officer in Hilla awarded $8.5 million to a contractor, Philip Bloom, in exchange for bribes, kickbacks, expensive vehicles, business class airline tickets, computers, jewelry, and other items, according to the Special Inspector General's report. At least he didn't sell himself cheap. Till others got needless cash infusions. One unspecified school requested $10,000 for refurbishments and got $70,000. Hey, have fun with it. Government contracting databases didn't even have, quote, an information management system that keeps track of everything built, according to Bowen. You can fly in a helicopter around Baghdad or other cities, Iraq's acting interior minister told Bowen, but you cannot point a finger at a single project that was built and completed by the United States, unquote. Shoveling money. Completion is overrated, don't you think? Shoveling money into a chaotic war zone created a triangle of political patronage that ensured corruption would be an institution unto itself in Iraq, in the view of the acting governor of the Iraq Central Bank. Iraq, by the way, ranks at the bottom of Transparency International's index of corruption. So we taught him something. David Petraeus told the Special Inspector General that reconstruction provided, quote, colossal benefits to Iraq, unquote. And he's so respected. Even projects that seemed like success stories ultimately underdelivered. According to Bowen, 9 major reconstruction projects for the energy infrastructure cost around $1.1 billion. By and large, they were each completed within 2 years of their original schedule. Within 2 years. And are a major reason why Iraq's energy supply stands at over 8,000 megawatts, compared to around 3,000 at the time of the invasion. The problem, according to Bowen's report, the estimated demand for electricity in the new Iraq is almost double that. Supply and demand, babe. To this day, Bowen finds it's impossible to say what the $4 billion program actually bought. Commander's record keeping was inexact and incomplete. This renders suspect commander narratives, academic studies, and other analyses that claim success based on that data. That includes the $370 million that we paid Sunni insurgents in 2007 and 2008 not to fight. Yet, despite all these defects, this program was pretty much exported whole hog, and I do mean hog, to Afghanistan. The U.S. government is not much better prepared for the next stabilization operation than it was in 2003, his report concludes. Where's that Dave Petraeus now? Federal inspectors confirmed this week that errors by the nation's air traffic controllers have increased sharply, challenging the FAA's contention that most of the jump was due to better data collection. In an audit released this week, the Inspector General for the U.S. Department of Transportation said that, quote, the increase in reported errors was linked in part to a rise in actual errors rather than increased reporting. The report renews concerns about aviation mistakes at a time when the FAA has warned that sequestration may be the thing. I'm not even going to dignify that. An official familiar with the report said it raises questions about the manner in which the FAA collects reports and classifies the mistakes made by the controllers responsible for safe air travel. The report is kind of an indictment of how they categorize and deal with these errors, said the official, who asked not to be identified, because he likes his job. The Inspector General's report cited a 95% increase in controller errors reported 3 years ago at the facility that supervises air traffic into the national capital's three major airports, Reagan National, Dulles International, and Baltimore Washington International. It was the fifth highest increase 3 years ago in the nation, outranked only by error increases in Florida, Houston, Miami, and that was, the first was Central Florida, and Southern California. All the places that have good weather had increases in bad in air traffic control errors. Is there something going on there? Are they sunning when they should be controlling? I only ask. And finally, there is a litany of troubling facts in a new report by Christy Romero, the Special Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, which pumped more than $600 billion into failing banks and other companies during the economic crisis. The report details the many billions of taxpayer dollars still sunk into struggling banks, hundreds of them. Some of them are still failing, and risks are still festering that could create a future crisis. So if you were worried that we're running out of crises, it's cool. The report is a reminder that even as the stock market goes to record heights, the crisis still is with us. In fact, the bailout could arguably have made a future crisis more likely by encouraging big banks to take on even more risks and the widespread belief that the government will always backstop them. The people taking those risks are insulated from the consequences. That's moral hazard, says Inspector General Romero. It continues to exist, and it must be dealt with. The report includes 74% stake in Ally Financial, held by you and me, which was rescued repeatedly during and after the crisis with little or no plan for ending the rescue. Why does a rescue have to end? Please. Ally still owes the government $14.6 billion and might ultimately cost the Treasury Department $5.5 billion in losses, according to the White House OMB, part of a total long-term TARP cost that could exceed $60 billion. Well, you know, we could have used that money to run another war. Treasury bailed out Ally without making the lender prepare a plan for unwinding its subprime mortgage portfolio. Then the government pumped more money into Ally on two separate occasions, again without any conditions or plans for dealing with its toxic mortgages. And even then, the lender was getting into trouble for its mortgage foreclosure practices. Last year, Ally paid $310 million to settle robo-signing charges. There are these liabilities and losses surrounding the former GMAC mortgages, now Ally, that caused massive losses in federal enforcement actions like the settlement, but there's no real requirement in TARP to address these issues, said Romero. Many of the banks the government owns are still struggling to make ends meet, or to make meat end, if they're vegetarian. Another 137 banks in the program simply refinance their TARP debts through other government loan programs designed for small banks and businesses. Treasury keeps saying taxpayers may ultimately realize a net gain on all the TARP and other programs. Romero says the government is ultimately going to lose billions of dollars on the bailout. News of Inspectors General. Ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. The new F-bomb, foreclosure, speaking of which, the nation's biggest banks wrongfully foreclosed on more than 700 members of the military. Support the troops during the housing crisis and seized homes from roughly two dozen other borrowers who are current on their mortgage payments. Findings that eclipse earlier estimates of the improper evictions. Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo, the usual suspects, uncovered the foreclosures while analyzing mortgages as part of a multi-billion dollar settlement deal with federal authorities, according to people with direct knowledge of the findings. In January, regulators ordered the banks to identify military members and other borrowers who were evicted in violation of federal law. The analysis was turned over to regulators in recent days. It provides the first detailed glimpse into the extent of wrongful foreclosures amid the collapse of the housing market. Lenders previously acknowledged they relied on faulty documents to push through foreclosures. The banks claimed borrowers were rarely evicted by mistake, because banks don't make mistakes. You see. The new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen. It's a nice F-bomb. It's foreclosure. Now, ladies and gentlemen, news of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. A former policeman and an ex-prison officer admitted this week to selling information to Rupert Murdoch's now-shuttered tabloid newspaper. Rupert Murdoch's still-existful tabloid newspaper, The Sun. These were the first guilty pleas to come out of a huge police investigation into wrongdoing by journalists who work for Rupert Murdoch.
Hmm?
You.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. It's all right. No reason to be sorry. Or maybe there is. The charges stem from an inquiry launched in 2011 into allegations that journalists from the now-defunct News of the World tabloid had hacked into mobile phone voicemail messages. That inquiry later widened to include other activities, including paying off public officials for stories. Former police officer Alan Tierney pleaded guilty to two counts of misconduct in public office for selling stories to The Sun about the mother of an England soccer player and about Rolling Stones member Ronnie Wood. Ex-prison officer Richard Trunkfield pleaded guilty to misconduct in public office for selling information about a high-profile prisoner.
I'm sorry, I take that back. Well, excuse me.
No, it's all right. Rupert, it's fine. They pled guilty. Don't have to take anything back. Rupert Murdoch, by the way, is said to have privately voiced doubts about his decision to set up a corporate cleanup unit that provided information to the police, leading to the arrest of 24 journalists for the Sun newspaper. News International sources, that is to say at Nice Corp, said Murdoch questioned whether he had made the right decision to set up the Management and Standards Committee, appearing as he did at a private summit here in London this week. He didn't call me.
Yeah, I think we can stand that embarrassment.
Okay. With many of the senior Sun executives, that was the summit, and journalists who've spent more than a year on bail, two sources said he expressed concern about the role the Management and Standards Committee had played. He questioned whether setting it up was the right decision. It has been heavily criticized for handing over internal emails to Scotland Yard, a decision that Murdoch has until now defended on the grounds the company had no choice but to cooperate with the police. Well, maybe it did. Maybe it didn't have to cooperate with the police after all. Many of the 24 arrests have been based on information handed to the police by the committee, leading to concern it was breaking one of the cardinal tenets of journalism, protecting the identity of sources.
Sources?
In Murdoch's own words, the MSC has actively cooperated with the Metropolitan Police, as well as the Department of Justice in the United States, turning over evidence of alleged or suspected illegality. This has led to the arrests of a number of Nice Corp employees. One of the first things it did was hand over 300 million internal emails? Can there be that many? To a police unit who were invited to share an office with the News Corp team in a building adjacent to the Sun's headquarters. The ensuing arrests have shocked staff in the Sun newsroom. Ladies and gentlemen, if you can shock people who work for the Sun, you've done something. Murdoch met with the Sun journalists and said he vowed to continue to pay the arrestees legal fees and offer whatever support was needed. He must be made of money. However, he said he could not, for legal reasons, tell them what would happen with regard to their employment if any were charged and found guilty. But you know what? Even if he can't tell him, he was still nice. News of Nice Corp. Nice people. Doing such nice things. Ladies and gentlemen, let us try. The motto of the United States Army Corps of Engineers. State and federal officials are working to stop an oil leak at Bonneville Dam in Washington State. It's putting an estimated 1 to 2 tablespoons of oil per day into the Columbia River. In case any salmon are suffering from dry skin, this should help. No, not really. While small, the leak has persisted intermittently for more than a month, according to the state of Washington. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has identified a source and is working on a fix. So if you salmon can just hold your breath until that happens, oil continues to seep from the 75-year-old hydroelectric facility into the water. We do everything we can to prevent oil from getting to the water, said the spokesman for the Army Corps. The leak appears to be coming from an oil-water separator. Isn't that ironic? Oil is getting into the water, coming out of an oil-water separator. Yes, it's ironic. It's not yet clear exactly what's causing it or when it will be resolved, says the spokesperson. Oil leaks are not uncommon in the Columbia Basin, which includes dozens of aging federal dams. The complicated, decades-old structures include many components that require oil to keep them running. In 2004, the Army Corps took heat for its handling of an oil spill at the Dalles Dam. They released 1,300 gallons of oil into the Columbia River. That's one of the unfortunate realities of having dams on the Columbia River, says Lauren Goldberg, staff attorney with the advocacy group Columbia Riverkeeper. She says it's also troubling to see only vague estimates of how much oil is spilled when such incidents happen. They don't have a really good way to measure that, she says. She should call the people at BP. They don't either. Let us try, ladies and gentlemen, the motto of the United States Army Corps of Engineers.
Take it now. My heart is carrying such a heavy load. One more ache would break it. It's like a camel with a heavy back, yeah. One last straw, they say, broke the camel's back. Oh,
from London. This is the show. And, ladies and gentlemen, just a little story. Just a little cute story. In the early part of the 2000s, there was a small cable channel that was an offshoot of the news channel run by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. It was devoted to world news, news of the world, news, what we call foreign news, because it's about, you know, foreigners. And it was called News World International, and it was on some cable systems in the United States. Not that many, but some. And it was a way that those few of us in the United States who might care about, you know, foreigners, could get some of that information on television, of all places. See what I'm saying? What happened to News World International was it was bought up by a man named Joel Hyatt, whom you may not have heard of, and a man you have heard of, Al Gore. And they bought News World International, not because they wanted to run News World International, but because they wanted the cable systems that carried News World International to carry their new channel called Current TV. And rather than just set up Current TV from scratch, they thought, well, there are these existing contracts. We can get on sooner with Current TV. Flash back forward to now. And Al Gore and his partner have just sold Current TV to Al Jazeera. And he was at South by Southwest this week. Who wasn't? And was facing a question about why Al Gore, Mr. Inconvenient Truth, sold Current TV to Al Jazeera, a news channel owned by the government of Qatar, which is in the oil business. You know, oil with the emissions and the thing. Here's Al Gore's answer.
I think that the addition of a very high quality, 24/7, honest to goodness news channel that covers international news as well as national, that covers climate, that covers poverty, that covers issues that are ignored today, has the potential to be disruptive in a creative and positive way and raise the game for television journalism here in the United States of America.
You mean like the channel you bought and shut down? So, a decade later, we may have another channel focusing on, you know, foreign news. And the only difference, aside from the silence on that score for the last 10 years, is Al Gore is $100 million richer. There's a story there. There's something to learn. Co-invest with Joel Hyatt is what I'd say. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. From the Guardian newspaper in London, the Pentagon sent a U.S. veteran of the dirty wars in Central America to oversee sectarian police commando units in Iraq that set up secret detention and torture centers to get information from insurgents. These units conducted some of the worst acts of torture during the U.S. occupation and accelerated Iraq's descent into full-scale civil war. You know about this? Colonel James Steele, then 58, was a retired Special Forces veteran nominated by Donald Rumsfeld to help organize the paramilitaries in an attempt to quell the Sunni insurgency, according to an investigation by The Guardian and BBC Arabic. After the Pentagon lifted a ban on Shia militias joining the security forces, the membership of the Special Police Commandos was increasingly drawn from violent Shia groups like the Badr Brigades. A second special advisor, retired Colonel James Kaufman, worked alongside Steele in detention centers that were set up with millions of dollars of U.S. funding. Kaufman reported directly to General Petraeus. Steele reported directly to Rumsfeld. The allegations made by both American and Iraqi witnesses to The Guardian and the BBC for the first time implicates U.S. advisors in the human rights abuses committed by the commandos. It's also the first time that General Petraeus has been linked through an advisor to this abuse. Kaufman reported to Petraeus and described himself in an interview with Stars and Stripes as Petraeus' eyes and ears on the ground in Iraq. They worked hand-in-hand, said General Mutadar al-Samari, who worked with Steele and Kaufman for a year while the commandos were being set up. I never saw them apart in the 40 or 50 times I saw them inside the detention centers. They knew everything that was going on there, the torture, the most horrible kinds of torture, unquote. The Guardian confirmed further details of how the interrogation system worked. Each single detention center was made up of an intelligence officer and 8 interrogators. This committee will use all means of torture to make the detainee confess, like using electricity or hanging them upside down, pulling out their nails and beating them on sensitive parts, unquote. There's no evidence that Steele or Kaufman tortured prisoners themselves, only that they were sometimes present in the detention centers where torture took place and were involved in the processing of thousands of detainees. The investigation was sparked by the release of classified U.S. military logs on WikiLeaks that detailed hundreds of incidents where U.S. soldiers came across tortured detainees in a network of detention centers run by the police commandos across Iraq. Samari, I'm going to see if I've mentioned his name before. Yes, General Samari. Claimed torture was routine in the commando-controlled detention centers, he said. Giles Perez, a photographer, came across Steele when he was on assignment. Sorry, Gilles Perez came across Steele when he was working on assignment as a photographer for the New York Times. The reporter Peter Moss was also there working on the Times story. While this interview was going on with a jihadi, with Jim Steele also in the room, a Saudi jihadi. Saudi, really? There were these terrible screams. Somebody shouting, Allah, Allah, Allah. It wasn't a kind of religious ecstasy or something like that. These were screams of pain and terror, unquote. The panel in Iraq provides an eerie parallel to the well-documented human rights abuses committed by U.S.-advised and funded paramilitary squads in Central America in the 1980s, where James Steele was head of a U.S. team of special military advisors that trained units of El Salvador's security forces in counterinsurgency. And he was visited there in 1986. By Dave Petraeus. Steele has not responded to any questions from The Guardian and BBC Arabic about his role in El Salvador or Iraq. The Guardian has learned that the special police commando unit's involvement with torture entered the popular consciousness in Iraq when some of their victims were paraded in front of the television audience on a TV program called Terrorism in the Hands of Justice. Detention centers bought video cameras funded by the U.S. military, which they used to film detainees for the television show. When the show began to outrage the Iraqi public, General Samari remembers being in the home of General Adnan Tabit, head of the special commandos, when a call came from Petraeus' office demanding they stop showing tortured men on television. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And it's not just the Guardian newspaper and the BBC Arabic service looking back. Reports surfaced this week that the Showtime pay television network in the United States will be airing a documentary about former Vice President Dick Cheney this coming Friday, in which he reviews the little struggle in Iraq and claims he would do it all over again exactly the same way. Wonder how all that came about.
Next, intimate tales of America's former underground vice president. The action-packed diary of the man who was just an enhanced heartbeat away from history. Dick Cheney. Confidential. Confidential. Confidential.
Whoever said the heart is a lonely hunter never had a pacemaker. Pacey and I have been hunting for vindication since we first opened a can of enhanced whoop-ass for Saddam Hussein during the early days of what the more naive among us referred to as the Bush presidency. But somehow the single-minded focus on so-called weapons of mass destruction had distracted a lot of so-called serious people from a simple fact. After all was said and done, Saddam Hussein was never again going to be in a position to try to assassinate George Herbert Walker Bush. Now, as the 10th anniversary of the war was approaching, I was being given the opportunity to, you might say, vindicate myself. One of the few forms of self-pleasuring my pacemaker would allow me. A paid television network had asked to film me for a documentary about me. I may not know everything in the world about leverage, but given my presumed central position in that particular scenario, it looked as though I had the whip hand. Fortified by some of Lynn's fine, low-fat breakfast gruel, I headed for my secure, undisclosed office with one mission in mind. Operation Get My Way. Tuesday, 10:17 a.m.
So, we did scout out this office, but in the end, we feel we'd have more control over sound and lighting if we built an office set sort of loosely based on this space.
Sound and lighting. I guess as a director, that's it's the sort of thing you tend to focus on.
Well, without those two factors under control, you might say I'd be peeing up a rope without a rope.
Cute. Here's something else that's cute.
Well, that was my good stopwatch.
Well, it stopped all right. Now listen here, pal. While you were spending the last 10 years directing cat food commercials, I was helping to direct the foreign and military policy of the most powerful nation on the planet. You make some enemies that way. Putting myself in your little studio is a fine way of making me more vulnerable than a starlet in a Turkish bath.
I also did all the really cool Cialis spots, but okay, I understand. We'll make this place work. Obviously, we'll need to bring in some more lights.
Normally, light's not my friend, but...
Shooting with just what you've got in here right now might give us a look that's, a little grim.
So far, I'm liking it. In any case, you'll favor my good side, I'm sure. The one where my mouth doesn't curl into a snarl.
That's in my notes, yes.
Right.
Now, we'll have the truck parked a block or so away, so we won't call attention to the location, if that's all right with your people.
Maybe you haven't grasped this potent little fact yet. I am my people. And there won't be any truck.
You know what? We'll shoot just two cameras, record in the cameras, everything else we can do in post. Fine, no problem. Now, Kelly here is the producer and writer. We'll be asking you the questions.
We'll have the questions finished up by a day before taping, so if you have any problem with any of them, we can hash it out before we shoot.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, good news. We've 86'd the hash.
Excuse me?
Here are the questions you'll be asking me. They're in all caps for easy reading.
No, I can see that, but... And certainly, we'll take these into consideration in our question formulation process, but obviously for this program to have the credibility and the gravitas that I think we all want it to have, clearly the questions have to be created by someone other than you.
Kelly, you're beautiful when you're hopelessly confused.
Well, thanks, but...
Obviously, it's important for all of us to safeguard the journalistic credibility of the Showtime Network. Otherwise, people might decide to stop watching Dexter.
We're a completely separate unit from...
Oh, I know. And that's why these questions weren't created by me. They were formulated by a completely separate unit. My wife.
Mr. Vice President, this is obviously an important project for all of us. We probably should try to conduct it in a way that's satisfactory to all of us.
No argument. And since this is a sealed max security space and I'm the only person with the proper chip in my leg to open that door... And since you folks could find yourselves spending the next little while in here with plenty of air and water and lots of Lynn's food, maybe our proposed little set of ground rules are more satisfactory to you than you realize.
I haven't really experienced something like this before.
If you're saying strength is a turn-on, I hear you loud and clear. Oh, and Mr. Director, just a couple more words about my needs.
Sure.
Final cut. It's so satisfying to bring people together. It warms the heart. And it warms Pacey, too. And a partial diary for the second week of March, 2013. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney. Confidential. Confidential.
Ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
An Alabama police chief brought Representative John Lewis to tears this week, apologizing to the noted civil rights leader for failing to protect the Freedom Riders during a trip to Montgomery, Alabama in 1961. Lewis and fellow civil rights activists were beaten by a mob after arriving at Montgomery's Greyhound bus station in May 61. This week on the ceremony at First Baptist Church, the city's current police chief, Kevin Murphy, apologized to Lewis and offered him his badge in a gesture of reconciliation, telling the longtime Georgia congressman that Montgomery police had enforced unjust laws in failing to protect the Freedom Riders more than five decades ago. Scottish Cardinal Keith O'Brien, who stepped down as Archbishop last week amid accusations of sexual impropriety, has apologized for his past sexual conduct. O'Brien issued a statement saying he contested early allegations made against him because of their anonymous and nonspecific nature. He offered no specifics this time, but did apologize for his behavior. Even with his admission of violating church teachings, O'Brien will be in the College of Cardinals, sending up that white smoke. Dayline Olympia Washington, a Washington state lawmaker, has apologized for saying that bicyclists contribute to climate change with their heavy breathing. Republican Representative Ed Orcutt of Kalama, the ranking minority member of the state's House Transportation Committee apologized for writing in an email last week that the act of riding a bike results in greater emissions of carbon dioxide from the rider. The United States has apologized after the mistaken killing of two young boys in Afghanistan. The victims, 11 and 12 years old, were collecting firewood with their donkeys when a helicopter opened fire. A recent U.S. airstrike in Kunar province killed up to 10 civilians. WHO frontman Pete Townsend has apologized for mouthing a profanity to a 7-year-old girl and her father who attended one of his Quadrophenia performances in Canada last month. The little girl apparently was holding a sign that read, "Smash your guitar, Pete!" In a video of the incident, Townsend spots the sign and addresses the girl's father, Eric. "Go away with that sign, please. Just go away with it," he says. "Don't bring your children. Use them. I want to tell you two words, but can't because you've got a child there." He then clearly mouths, "F off," while the audience claps and cheers. Townsend has now sent the Costellos a letter offering apologies and condolences from my side and very best wishes to you and your family. He also said, "I thought your placard was fun." He's made arrangements to meet with the Costellos in April. Maybe he'll smash something then. Oh, I'm sorry, Pete. Dayline Oakland, the mayor of a California city, apologized for a lock-picking class being mentioned in her most recent newsletter. Residents of Oakland, which saw a 40% increase in burglaries, said they were outraged to see Mayor Gene Kwan's newsletter promoting a lock-picking class. It said lock-picking sets would be offered for sale. Kwan apologized to any residents upset by the listing. She said her newsletter is more than 20 pages long and includes numerous listings. I and our editor will do a better job reviewing these listings in the future before sending them out, she says. Bulgaria has apologized for taking part in the deportation of more than 11,000 Jews from Greece and what is now Macedonia during World War II. This was in a declaration which was unanimously adopted by the Bulgarian parliament on Friday. In total, 48,000 Jews were supposed to have been deported from Bulgaria. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has apologized to a woman whose complaint of abuse was not taken seriously by a senior Church of England cleric. And conservative provocateur James O'Keefe has agreed to pay $100,000 and apologize to a former Acorn employee who was fired after being portrayed in one of O'Keefe's undercover video stings. The lawsuit by Juan Carlos Vera said the taping violated a state law against recording someone without their permission. A city council person who said children with disabilities should be put down to save taxpayers' money has resigned and apologized. Colin Brewer, an independent Cornwall councillor. "I was wrong. I admit it. I will continue to apologize," he said. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide, throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, supporting our troops and not foreclosing on them. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it. HarryShearer.com and KCRW.com. Available as a free podcast through KCRW.com. And available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com. And available now through SideshowNetworks.com, too, it turns out. Thank you very much. And it'd be just like co-investing with Joel Hyatt, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Tip of the chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in Exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks, just like last week, to Adrian Bonham here at Global Radio in London. A dude who actually took apart his iPhone and successfully put it back together again. I'm stunned at the technical expertise sitting here beside me. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music heard here on, and a fabulous store, all yours, when you go to HarryShearer.com. And I'll see you on Twitter, by which I mean you may read me on Twitter. Join the almost 83,000 folks, if you like, at the Harry Shearer. My thanks to the folks at BBC Six Music for being such great hosts to me for my little hour jaunt on their station today at a ball. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions. It originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. I'm going to go out and spend some daylight. Not worth saving. So long from London.